What's going on, guys? Kevin Estello of Fieldcraft Survival. I'm the host of this advertisement for this podcast. Guys, this podcast is only possible with our sponsors, with the folks that advertise here, and I want to recognize two of them. The first sponsor is Sig Sauer. Guys, Sig Sauer is more than a firearms company. Sig Sauer produces a lot of the accessories for those firearms that they do make, including amazing ammunition. I want to talk to you about that ammunition just for a hot second. I'm a ballistics nerd. I've attended the Sig Sauer Academy, precision scope rifle, advanced precision scope rifle, reach for 1,000. When I was living out in Utah and we were using the Kefaru property out there, I mean, I was shooting out to 980 yards on a regular basis. And I'll tell you some of the best ammo that I found to do that, Sig Sauer ammunition. Something that you should know about their ammo in ballistics and long range shooting, you got to know what standard deviation is between the rounds. You don't want one round that's going, say, 2,600 feet per second and another round that's going 2,400 feet per second out of the same lot. Well, the Sig ammo has a very, very low standard deviation. That's what I've found. We're talking only 5 feet per second, which is very negligible. So I love the stuff that Sig puts out there. They make great, great ammo, including some really good ammo for their 365. They have a special round that is designed for that pistol and other short micro compact pistols like the 365. So I'm a huge fan of Sig and I'm very thankful for them being, you know, one of the podcast sponsors. And of course, if you are going to train and you're going to carry a pistol, maybe you're going to carry their ammunition, then I would recommend that you guys train at the Sig Sauer Academy. It's up in New Hampshire and they also have training around the country, but that's their primary location. And the Sig training is awesome. You can do everything from pistol to carbine to shotgun to precision scope rifle. You name it, you can do it there. So guys, please head over to SigSauer.com, take a look at all the things that they have to offer. Now, there's another company that I want to recommend, and it's what I currently have in my tumbler right here, and that is Hoist Hydration. There is a 10% off discount if you use the code FIELDCRAFT10. That is FIELDCRAFT10. Guys, go to the website, www.drinkhoist.com. Hoist Hydration is pretty awesome because it has very little sugar. If you spend a lot of time working out, you need to replace your electrolytes. Hoist is a great drink to do that. In addition, Hoist has no artificial colors. So, you know, you go to the store and like you want to get an energy drink, and a lot of people, mainly kids, get attracted by like the bright colors that they see in the refrigerator. Well, you're not going to find that with Hoist, but you are going to find a drink that is going to help you rehydrate. And it's used by a lot of elite athletes. Our instructors here at the company love Hoist. When I was out in Utah, we'd get cases of Hoist, and every once in a while, I'd be able to steal one or two away from our marketing director, who has a whole refrigerator of it. So if you guys ever go to our tower office, or if you ever run by his office, go to his refrigerator. Maybe he'll never notice it. Take a couple of the bottles, try it out. I think you're going to love it. Guys, Hoist Hydration is awesome stuff. I found it nationally, right? You can probably find it in your grocery store, or you, like I said, you can go to www.drinkhoist.com and you can use that coupon code FIELDCRAFT10 and get yourself a discount off of Hoist. So I'm going to tell you, it's good stuff. You know, people say you need to hydrate. I agree. Most people are walking around dehydrated. Well, you might want to do something about that. You might want to drink Hoist. All right, guys, here we go. Let's get to this podcast. Hey guys, welcome to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I'm your host for this episode. My name is Kevin Estella. I'm the director of training here. And I've got a good friend in front of me, a guy who I think you guys are going to learn a lot from, and someone who is in the primitive skills community, one of the guys that you look to. You know, I first met Doug in 2021. I was at Blade Show and my buddy Joe Zilla, who was on the podcast recently, Joe Flowers, was like, "Hey, you got to come out and meet Doug Meyer. He wants you to sign his book." And I'm like, "Okay, I'll run out there." And we talked, and the next, you know, Doug gives me a Choya cactus handled knife, and you know, we start talking. And recently I traveled out to you know, Doug's home, his museum, his library, which is the most amazing library I've ever seen on survival books, with my buddy Brian Edwards, who's one of our instructors here also. He goes by Wilderness Woodcraft on Instagram. And then I was like, "Doug, we got to get you out for the podcast." So this podcast is going to be one for the books. And we are going to talk about Doug's book and some other stuff. And we're going to get to it right now. So Doug, thanks for coming.
Thanks, Kevin.
Man, I don't even know where to begin with you because you've done a lot. We can start with what you were saying earlier about the Army, right? You spent some time in the Army?
Right. I spent a little bit of time in the Army. I was a combat engineer. I don't push my military background because 90% of people that are in the military don't learn anything about survival. Not about outdoor survival. You might learn stuff about surviving in a battlefield or something like that, mm-hmm. but that doesn't equate to what I'm teaching or anything like that. So I try to say this, you know, I served, I had a good time. It paid for my college education. And like I said, I don't regret doing it. It was an honor to serve for my country, but I didn't learn any survival skills at all really in the Army.
You know, try telling that to the folks from Hollywood that are like, oh, we got to get a military survival guy.
Yeah.
And you know, the folks from Hollywood that put all these different personalities on TV shows, they want to say like military survival is top notch. Like these guys are tier one. But you and I both know there are folks out there who never served, they never even carried a firearm, but they're fantastic with primitive technology or traditional technology, and they would run circles around the guys that go through some of those programs. And for someone like you who became one of those folks that could run circles, I mean, it speaks volumes for you to say that about the survival training that's provided in the military. And even guys that, you know, we've had on before, like we had a SEER specialist on recently, Jason Smith, Hobo Forge. And he was saying how, you know, it's a very, very limited survival training that they get, even in the SEER specialist compared to like the long-term survivalists that are out there. So I'm not trying to throw shade. I'm just talking about, you know, the reality of survival training. I mean, what was the extent that you've seen or heard of? Was it the ammo can and the chicken? Boil the chicken in the ammo can? Or?
Yeah, but like I was a combat engineer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're clearing minefields and looking for, you know, enemy explosives, building bridges, roads, stuff like that. You're not doing anything. So you don't really get any, you know, that you might have like an 8-hour where they just skim the surface or something mm-hmm. like that, but it's not, it's very basic. You know, you're not getting real survival training until you're, you know, in Rangers, Green Berets,
right,
really
right.
up there in the top echelon of the military. You know, that's when you're starting to get into that kind of stuff. And even a lot of that is not, because the problem that people don't understand in the military, when you're behind enemy lines, you don't want to be found. And that's the whole purpose of survival. You know, you want to be found in a civilian situation, mm-hmm. but if you're behind enemy lines, you don't want to, you know, be found. So it's a whole different skill set.
Agreed. Yeah.
You know, so you can't equate some of that to just like outdoor survival. You know, out in the wilderness, you are a national forest, right near here. It's not the same thing. You're trying to be found.
Yeah. And on the flip side of the coin, I would say that a lot of those folks that could run circles around the military guys, those military guys would be able to escape, evade better than any of those guys that maybe they can run circles, but maybe they also are used to just like plopping down next to a fire and they're not super active. So they might have packed on a couple pounds. So I guess, you know, you take the good with the bad with both backgrounds.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where did you pick up your skill set then? Because, I mean, when I went to your home, your museum, your, I don't even know what you call it, the workshop?
Both, all of it.
All of it. Yeah. I mean, you have everything under the sun there from all different regions. I mean, you have stone products, you have wood products, you have clay and pottery. I mean, like, where did you pick this up? Where do you even begin to learn the primitive tech?
Okay, so I was in college and I was majoring, double major in archaeology and history. And I took this class, this summer class, and it was called Southeastern Indians. And it was one of those 2-week classes where it's mm-hmm. like 8 or 9 hours a day. It's, you know, so we went on a lot of field trips. So we went to the field trip to the Shield Museum, and it was in Gastonia. And it wasn't far from my house. It's 40 minutes from my house. And we go to this Catawba Indian village, and this guy's going to talk about Catawba Indians. And it was Steve Watts. And he was, you know, just his 35-minute program just blew me away. He's the first person I ever saw make an arrowhead. He's the first person I saw do bow drill fire. He shot a blowgun dart over my head. He had a target over my head and shot a freaking blowgun dart over my head. And I was like, what the heck is this? You know, I'm sitting there, you know, in archaeology, you're moving a lot of dirt and you're finding artifacts and stuff like that. But this guy was like, whoa, this is a whole nother level. And, you know, and I'm talking to him afterwards and he goes, well, I teach classes at the museum. And so he did like classes every month, one class a month. And, so immediately I started taking classes from him. And, you know, I took classes up to the point he died. And he died in 2016. I probably took a couple hundred classes from him.
Wow.
You know, in the interim of all that, we became good friends. We did Revolutionary War reenacting together. And we had another mutual friend who I met from him, Eric Callahan. He's was probably one of the best flint knappers. He died 3 years ago in the United States. And Eric got sick and he broke his back and we thought he was going to die. So we spent at least once a month, we'd go up and go see Eric and spend time with him. And, you know, Eric outlived Steve by 3 years. It was one of those, but to see him after he had after he mm-hmm. broke his back, you were like, man, this man's about to die, you know? And so I had to see both of them, you know, die. And Steve's was such a shock. It was, he had a workshop and it was at the Show Museum was on fire making. And then a week later, he was dead. He was given a program at the same Indian village I did, probably the same program.
Mm-hmm.
And they found him passed out at the village and he went to the hospital and he initially had congestive heart failure.
Mm-hmm.
And what was happening was he wasn't, you know, you take a diuretic and it takes the fluid off him and he wasn't drinking enough and it messed up his kidney.
Stress his body that much.
Yeah. It messed up his kidney and his kidney shut down. It was a tough, and you know, like, and it was like 2 months before I had a dog that had the same issue. And he was at my house and he looks at their medicine on the counter and he goes, her name was Angel. He goes, dang, Angel, we're taking the same medicine. And he kind of joked about it. Well, a week before he died, my dog got really sick. And same thing, her kidney was shutting down too. And they fixed her, you know, somebody that can't talk. And, mm-hmm. you know, and she ended up living another 5 months. But, you know, so when I heard what was wrong, I said, well, you know, they fixed my dog. You know, she's not going to die, you know. And it was just such a wow.
How old was he?
Dang, 63.
Wow.
No. Now he smoked heavily, but as soon as he found out he had heart stuff, and it went on for about a year, he quit smoking. I mean, he just quit cold turkey, and he was just that disciplined a person, like diets and stuff like that. If he decided to go on a diet, he could just bam, you know.
At the company here, obviously we tell people, you know, we want to train them for the worst case scenario, right? Like that's our company mission, preparing civilians for the worst case scenario. And everyone thinks the worst case scenario is going to be, you know, like the Russians are coming,
yeah,
right? Or
yeah.
Worst case scenario, there's going to be the super tornado or something, you know, that isn't very possible or probable. The most possible and probable thing that kills people in this country is heart disease.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not as easy to sell people on the idea like, hey, maybe you need to work out just a little bit. Like,
yeah.
Change your diet a little bit. Like your investment in your health is something that is you can do every single day and you won't see the benefit of it until you're much later in life. But there are folks out there who throw caution to the wind, you know, and then you say to yourself, you're like, again, that guy died at 40 something. Why? You know, and then you find out the lifestyle that they lived and it's like, did they know the risk? Possibly. Did they not care? It's so important to take care of your health. You know, if you don't have your health, you can't do any of the other good stuff.
Yeah.
Now, when you said you took these 200 classes with Steve Watts, what was like the first skill set where it was like a knowledge transfer where you're like, I've got it. Like I'm learning. Like, do you remember the first time you had that aha moment?
There was so much, but Steve was such a great teacher.
Mm-hmm.
He taught... He followed Eric's teaching, the way Eric taught. Eric broke everything down into stages. You know, if you're making a certain type of arrowhead of a certain length, you have to have this biface at this level. And if it's not so wide or so thick, you're not going to, he could look at it and go, it's not going to make it. It would be a reject. Because he was so disciplined. He knew, like when he pressure flaked, he knew exactly how much he was going to remove every stage of the game. He made little cardboard templates and Steve took that to everything. You know, if you're making anything like a war club or whatever, you have to get the wood thin and then you have to do this and you have to do this. And sometimes you didn't even know where you were going in this journey when you were doing something like that. He said, everybody do this. And then everybody would do that. And then everybody do this and everybody does. And then you see it happen and you're like, dang, that was, you know, and it was just such a great way to teach. And Steve always had, a great lecture before every class, because if you didn't put the item that you're making into context, mm-hmm. it was just arts and crafts.
Right.
You know, so he explained the whole concept. Like if you're talking about blowguns, he talked about blowguns all over the world. And then, you know, we would make river claim, became blowguns. And they would, he would move into the Southeast and talk about river cane and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, and then you'd make them. So you had like the whole worldwide perspective. And then the whole, he would draw it into the Southeast, every skill that he did. And that's what a lot of people don't understand. You know, most of these skills are universal. They're not like, you know, all Native American. Right. You know, blowguns are all over the world. Fire making's all over the world. Flint knapping's all over the world. There's not one group that owns that. They might own a certain type, like point type or style or something like that, but everybody flintknapped in the world. Everybody made fires.
To your point, I remember being in your house and you've got that one display that shows the flintknapping, and it's like, okay, these are Scandinavian style points. These are North American style points. And over the years, you know, obviously teaching here and there, I've had people say, you're a white man teaching Native American skills. And I'd say, correction, I'm half white, I'm half Filipino. And these aren't just Native American skills. Like they're found in Australia, they're found in Europe, they're found but people have a hard time grasping that concept, because I think it's the idea that, how do you explain that all of these technologies, they kind of evolved around the same time all around the world, yet those people never interacted with one another? Like that's to me, one of the greatest history mysteries.
Oh yeah.
You know, do you have a theory on that?
Not a theory, but
are you going to say aliens?
No, I'm not going to say aliens. I'm definitely not going to say aliens. It's because we're all human, mm-hmm. and being human, even back in the past, we're all lazy, and there's easy ways to do things, and we all have the same type of brain that we can figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because even a concept like bow and arrow. You know, that's a worldwide thing, but where it came about, like in Europe, it's 6,000-8,000 years ago, but in North America, it's, you know, it was just right before contact. It's very late, same concept. Some of it had to do with, a lot of it had to do with what they were hunting, you know, the megafauna and stuff like that, the woolly mammoths and the oryx and stuff they're hunting in Europe. When they died out, you don't need an atlatl anymore because the animal's faster. A deer or an elk can run really fast. And mm-hmm. That's a harder target to hit with an atlatl, but it's easier to hit with a bow. You get into that kind of concept a deer can run really quick. You can't sit here and you know, mess around with an atlatl because the weights are a big mystery in atlatls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they only find weights in North America. You know, why did they only find them there? And the weights aren't, they don't make you throw it better. They stabilize it, because you can't sit there and hunt a deer and go, oh, there's a deer. I got to pull my dart out, put it on my atlatl, and, you know, make a bunch of noise. There's no way to do it quietly. The deer's gone. So you have to walk around with a deer, I mean, with your atlatl dart stuck in your atlatl, and it's all that weight pressure's on your shoulder. The weight's taking the pressure off your shoulder. So why you don't find them in Europe is they'd already had the bow. They had the bow at the same time as they had the atlatl. And as soon as the megafauna died out, they just went right to the bow. And it took longer for the Native Americans in, you know, the United States to figure out a bow. So they changed the atlatl to work for that.
We need to do two things at this point in this podcast, because people are probably listening saying, what the hell's an atlatl?
Okay.
And I mean, so hold on, before we move forward, and then you also mentioned blowguns. So I think what we need to say is, I mean, you've flown to different museums around the world to help with historical accuracy of exhibits and make artifacts that they can put on display. Like, you are a noted authority in this technology, and there's no question in my mind. Can you kind of speak to that for a second, but then also kind of just walk us through the timeline of what came first, chicken or the egg, or what came first, spear, blowgun, bow and arrow, atlatl, woomera, like run through the timeline real quick?
Yeah. But yeah, I've been mostly in Europe. I went to, the first time I went to Europe, I went to Denmark, and I was at the Lyra Research Center. It's about an hour outside of Copenhagen. They had a Stone Age festival, and they had people from all over the world, dressing up in, your buckskin clothes and demonstrating Stone Age technology. And it's a museum. And so the public's walking through, and you can basically demonstrate whatever you want as long as it's within the Stone Age technology. So that's the first time that, I went to Europe. And then I went to Lyra again. I've been to Holland several times, been to Germany, I've been to Sweden, you know, just all over. But as far as weapons, you know, the first weapon, and people don't think about stuff like this. A rock, man, pick up a rock and throw a rock.
Yeah, the acronym is BFR, right?
Big
freaking rock.
You know, you pick up a rock and throw it like a baseball and you know, hit a rabbit and you kill it. You know, it's very simple, you know. And then they got pointy sticks. How the spear could have developed, you know, you don't know. Nobody was there that's alive. These digging sticks, that's a stick with a pointed end on it to dig up vegetables. Cause try to dig up a Jerusalem artichoke with your bare fingers. It's, you know, it doesn't take long to go, this sucks, I'm going to get a stick. And I'm going to point the stick and it's going to make it easier to dig. So you're sitting there messing around, digging something up. And then, you know, some animal such as a badger that's got that nose and it smells the earth moving or something like that, or a groundhog. Anything like that burrows, they come up on you and you're like, oh crap, you know, and you take that stick and you stick it into the animal and then you go, whoa, that's a spear, you know?
Right.
And the first spear was a thrusting spear. And you know, that's where you just stick it in there. And it's heavy and, it's defensive too, because, you know, in the prehistoric past, there's wolves and bears and all kinds of crazy stuff that can eat you. And they've got teeth and, you know, claws and stuff that we don't have. So, you know, you start out with a spear and then you get into throwing spears. That's the natural evolution to, dang, I don't want this thing to get 5 feet from me. I'm going to throw something at it when it's 12 feet away, 20 feet away. You know, I'm going to try to get some distance between me. And then they still didn't have points on them yet. Then they figured out how to put stone points on, and they were all crude at first, but they were effective. After you get stone points in, you get into stuff like, Johnny's arms are 6 inches longer than me. He can throw the spear longer. How can I make my arm longer? And you make an atlatl, a spear thrower. And that moves your elbow from where your elbow is to where your wrist is. And you can make your spear thrower as long as you want to. And that makes you be able to throw a spear further. After you can throw the spear, you realize, man, I'm hitting this animal and the spear's breaking off right at the skin and it's getting away. You know, how can I stop this? So they created a foreshaft. And that's a hardwood piece that sticks in the end of your spear. It's got an arrowhead or some kind of point on it. And that sticks into the animal. Well, then the rest of the spear breaks off. I mean, it detaches.
Like a land-based harpoon.
Correct. And so then what happens is every time his leg hits it, it's taking that spear point and moving it into it. So it's killing. Every time it runs by and hits a bush or anything that's hitting that stick, it's moving that spear point. That's slowly killing it, but it's also creating a blood trail, so it's easier to follow. So then you got all kinds of stuff going on. After that, you know, then all your exotic weapons, your bows come out, mm-hmm. your throwing sticks, your blowguns, all that stuff comes, you know, after that. The spear was the first, the stick and the spear was the first. So what's crazy, what people don't understand, like the oldest returning boomerang, where do you think that was found?
I don't even want to guess. I know. People are probably thinking Australia.
Yeah, and it's
because that's what I'm.
Holland thinking. Is where the
Holland.
The
old,
yeah, Europe was the oldest returning. It's from the Iron Age. The boomerang that was found there. So that's like, what? You know. So you're saying people in Europe were using returning boomerangs. It's something that's totally you think is Australian. Mm-hmm. But you know, you start seeing that, and you're like, man. And people threw sticks, you know, all over, you know, but you know, the returning that you always think of as totally Australian, you know.
Getting back to your point about the spear, where you said they first were wooden spears and then they attached a point. What are your thoughts on just the sharpened stick versus a stone point, like expediency, like everything's a trade-off, right? So, I mean, what are your thoughts on just sharpening a stick, fire hardening that point, versus spending the time to flake or fashioning a point?
Well, I mean, obviously a stone point is better than a sharpened stick, but if that's all you've got, you know, you're talking, they probably used prehistorically, you know, like they probably just used sharpened sticks for like several million years, you know, mm-hmm. 1.2, you know, right around there, million years. You know, that carried their, you know, that fed them and that defended them from predators for millions of years before somebody got the idea to put a rock on the end of it. Right, you know, because survival is living. And if you live for that long, and they probably lived that long without being able to create fire, you know, they were probably picking up fire from, you know, going to the edge of a lava flow and catching a stick on fire, or where lightning struck a tree and caught something on fire, and they had to just keep the fire going and going and going. So you're talking about crude living, but it was still living, you know,
right.
It still carried on for millions of years like that before, you know, they figured out rocks and stuff like that. And you know, the concept of a rock, of flints or cherts or anything like that, it's not every rock, it's just certain rocks. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that guy was a genius. And it was probably something as simple as they picked up a rock to throw at an animal and it hit a bigger rock and it cracked in half. And they said, whoa, this is sharp. You know, this,
right.
You know, I could put this on the end of my stick and you know, here it is.
You know, what's interesting is I've had people say like, well, just going out in nature and just looking at things, where's the excitement in that? It's like, it doesn't always have to be excitement. It can be learning. I've got a theory for the spear. And this one goes back to a camping trip I was on with my late mentor and his wife and a bunch of their friends. And his wife, Aggie, brought out steaks, venison steaks. And I'm like, she goes, oh, I just got this deer the other day. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, okay, hunting season's over. Aggie, how did you get this deer? And she said, well, this is in the wintertime. The deer was jumping. Or I'm sorry, she was snowshoeing along their property and she found a dead deer with a wound in its side, and they didn't allow hunting on their property ever. So when she dressed the deer and she pulled out what impaled the deer, it was a branch from a tree that had fallen through the trees, and now it created a sharp point, and that little fawn jumped and landed on top of it, which hit the organs and out cold.
Yeah.
So my theory is something like that might've happened, but getting back to that point of observation, like, what a cool observation, you know, like you never know what you're going to see when you go out in the great outdoors. And it doesn't have to be always super high speed, or, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, very mission focused, other than just go out there and see what you're going to see and watch how animals do things. Cause some of the best technology comes from like mimicking animals.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You know,
and I'm always, when I'm walking, oh, that branch would make a good boomerang. That would mm-hmm. make, I'm constantly looking and seeing stuff, like, you know, my wife says I can spot thistle for making blowgun darts, at 80 miles an hour going down the interstate, you know, she says, you just I dog bane. There's certain plants that I can just, you know, I'm driving and oh, there it is.
And, yeah.
So, you know, if I can see it in a vehicle when I'm walking, gosh, what I can find.
Let's talk about those blowguns, because when I met you, you showed me an early copy of the blowgun book.
Uh-huh.
And truth be told, my experience with blowguns is the quote unquote survival blowgun that you buy from Smoky Mountain Knife Works. It's $15. It's an aluminum tube. It has a mouthpiece. And you're using sharpened wire darts. And then I played a little bit with the cold steel blowgun, but you've actually written the book on primitive blowguns from all over the world, and you continue to make them. Joe Flowers told me, he's like, Kev, you got to see some of Doug's blowguns. And I saw them in your house. Can you kind of talk about blowgun technology and maybe kind of set the record straight as far as like what they're capable of, and then dispel some rumors?
Sure. I typically make Southeastern Native American blowguns. And you're talking the Cherokee, the Creek, the Choctaw, the Uchi, the Seminole. It had to be confined to the Southeast because that's where river cane grew. And river cane is the only native species of bamboo that's found in America. And they know they had it because they've never found a blowgun, but they found baskets and stuff up in rock shelters. So they know they had the material and that it was here prehistorically. It's really historically, you don't know, because none of them had written languages. Mm-hmm. So it's when the first white people come in and then they start saying, oh, these two kids had a blowgun. And it's stuff like that, that you're getting. You're not getting any information about how they made them or anything like that. But they, you know, that's the first, my first love, because Steve, you know, showed me that stuff. And that was the first blowguns that I was making. They didn't use any poison. The darts are like 19 inches long. They're hardwood carved. It's the weight that's killing. They're killing small game. They're killing rabbits. They're killing squirrels. They're killing birds. Every once in a while, you'll see a reference where they say they killed turkeys, but they shot them in the eye and stuff like that. You know, but you're like, okay. I don't know about turkeys back in the past, but turkeys today, to shoot in the eye, it's pretty, you know, that's a great shot. But I've taken turkey bodies after they've been killed, and I can't get a dart through the wing and into the body and penetrated enough that I could kill a turkey like that. So it would have to be a headshot to do that. But they didn't use any poison at all. Now, the Cherokee had a reference to using mayapple, mandrake, on their arrows to hunt enemies and stuff like that. So they had the knowledge that the poison was there. They just didn't, you see no references for anything like that. Where you see poison show up, and it's South America, Southeast Asia, Africa.
The curare poison.
It's right? Curare and the poison dart frogs. And curare is a tree bark. It's not a, you know, it's not, and they distill it down. And that's basically boiling it till it's thick. And that's how they make their poison. And what's crazy is they sell, the wood from the curare trees. You can go to like exotic wood stores, and sometimes it'll still have pieces of bark on like when they did a rough cut. You'll see that it's funny. So if you got a little bit of knowledge, it's not impossible to find even in the United States. Where they're using poison, they're hunting bigger prey, and they're hunting monkeys, and monkeys are like us. They have hands. The first thing you do after you scream Vashichi is you pull the dart out, and that's what a monkey's going to do. So if you hit a monkey in a non-vital place and it pulls the dart out, you're not going to kill it. But it's a game changer when you put poison on the end of the dart, and then even though he pulls the dart out, he's still got the poisons in him, and he's going to die. So that's when you start getting into poisons. There's very few references where they're using blowguns to kill people and stuff. There are a lot of sketchy references. You don't see a lot of references where 500, you know, natives were all using blowguns and they wiped out all this whole, and that they're not doing.
Yeah, the opening scene of Raiders of the Lost Ark, right?
You're not seeing a lot of that. Where that guy's got like 200 blowgun darts in his back and stuff like that. It's cool though. You just don't see that. And so I wrote the book because it needed to be written. And then after Steve passed, it really needed to be written. The story needed to be told because he wrote the first article that was, I would call a legitimate article about blowgun, making blowguns and stuff like that. And he always believed that they split them. And he was basing that on concepts of wooden blowguns from South America. They would take the wood and they'd split it. They'd carve a groove in it and they'd bind it back together. And you can split river cane very easily. But it's a long, drawn out process.
Start to finish, how long does it take to make one?
One like that is several hours because you have to heat straighten the blowgun. Mm-hmm. And then after you heat straighten it, then you split it. And if you don't heat straighten it and you try to split it and it's got kinks in it, it's not going to split right. So you got to heat straighten it. Then you split it. Then you clean out all the joints and then you bind it back together. So that's how he thought they did it. Around 89, he was thinking that. And then I started messing around and I saw a reference in another book where they said they punched them out. I punched them out with smaller diameter piece of cane. And when they're green, they punch out real easily. You can just almost push it out, just pop, pop, pop. So you're talking 5 minutes, you push one out, and then you go to a bigger diameter piece of cane and keep making your holes bigger and bigger. And then after you get it as big as you can get the cane down into it, you can take like a slurry of sand and water and you can just sand out the last little bit that you need to do. And, you know, I can make a gun like that 30 minutes.
Wow.
And when Steve saw that, he was like, oh yeah, that's how they were doing it. You know, because like I said, I still think we all have that lazy brain. We all want to do something really that's just a little bit of time, a lot of gratification. And so like I said, and you know, I enjoy making blowguns. So sometimes it's a process and I'll sit there and I'll be in front of the fire and I'll be heat straightening and I might take 2 or 3 hours just, you know, making it perfect and doing that. But I'm doing it because I'm enjoying it.
Right.
Where, you know, but I can still teach a class and most people can make a blowgun pretty quick, you know, a couple hours. And you spend all the time on the darts. The darts are the mastery thing.
Let's talk about those for a second. So you were saying that they were a hardwood dart. And I'm assuming it's some type of kapok around the back end?
It's a thistle, but okay, kapok is South American. Mm-hmm. And you can still get kapok. The old, get on eBay, and the old life preservers had kapok in them.
Yeah, the Mae West ones, right?
Yeah. So you can get those and rip those open and get kapok fibers. But thistle was the big thing. And they also used cotton, and that's a little bit different technology. They used animal fur, and then they used bird feathers. And the thistle is just, you know, it's all winding technique, and the string's in your mouth, and, you know, it's a crazy thing. And I just put a video up on Facebook and Instagram on that, just because those reels are 90 seconds, you know.
Right.
You got 90 seconds to do something. I said, well, I can bust this out in 90 seconds. And it was the worst piece of thistle that I could have possibly picked. But I pulled out a dart, you know, it's not, you know, man, so many comments, the troll comments and stuff. You're just like, what?
If only the trolls knew, you know what I mean? Well, I always say that, like, if only they knew who these people are that they're commenting or spent any time with them, they would never open their mouths.
But it was like, and I realized when it's a reel, some of the people making comments don't know anything about survival, primitive technology. They're just some random person that saw this and said, oh, it's cool. But, you know, and there was comments like, well, the lion would have eaten you by the time you you did that. And you're like, well, you know, I wouldn't go hunting a lion with a freaking blowgun. That wouldn't even be my top thing. And, you know, this is a demonstration. If I go hunting with my blowgun, I've already made the darts. They're already done. You know, I'm not sitting here making a dart, you know, and making a bunch of noise right before I do it. The darts are done. I just made the dart in 30 seconds and shot it into a tree just to show you that it worked. But like I said, I had people, oh, well, you didn't really make a dart. You just, because you didn't show making the stick. And you're just like, okay, you know.
Yeah, the trolls are always quick to project their own ideas and the limitations of their intelligence onto whatever platform, right? Like, oh, that's not how you do it. This is how I would do it. And it's like, well, you're doing it wrong, you know? Yeah. I mean, they love projecting their ideas, which are often wrong. And they're usually out of context. Or they watch the video, but they don't read the comment. Or they don't read the
title.
Caption. Right, yeah. Right.
I mean, I titled it Thistle Blow Gun Dart. And, oh, well, you didn't title it right because you didn't make the dart. Okay. And then my comment to that guy was, well, you know, when you write the book like I did on it, then you can tell me what I can title my own video. Mm-hmm. And, man, so many people called me a pompous ass for making that comment. Oh, and you're just like, and what people don't realize is, all right, I'll try to educate a troll. But if you start going anywhere, it's my video. I can delete your comment. I don't mm-hmm. have to. It's yeah. pressing the button. Yeah. You know, I got control, you know.
It is a great feeling, though. Like when you know that someone spent probably 30 minutes, 45 minutes of their life writing out this giant paragraph, and it takes me like a second to hit delete. And it's like, guess what? All of your energy is mine.
Yeah. I never thought about it like that. But and I just started deleting comments, you know. Yeah, it's like, yeah. Come on, you know. But it's just like, man, you don't realize what you saw, mm-hmm. and you want to sit there and nitpick it apart. But you know, and I've got longer videos on my Facebook and Instagram account that have, you know, really long detailed explanations of what I'm doing and stuff like that. But I had 90 seconds. You know, I wanted to do something quick. Mm-hmm. And it did. It went crazy. I got almost, like last night I had over on Instagram, 700,000 people watched, wow. You know, and you're like, what?
Well, it's such a rare market that you're in. Like I can show someone how to use a ferro rod. I can show someone how to use a bow drill, but there are not a lot of people out there that can show someone how to make a blowgun. I can't do that.
Yeah.
I mean, my blowgun would be ugly as sin. Yours would be historically accurate and beautiful. And
yeah, but it's one of those, I got a Steve mentality on stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I want you to succeed and have something pretty.
Right.
So sometimes I'll take somebody's blowgun and I'll go, hold on a second. And let me see. I'll get the kink out that they've been working 30 minutes on to try to get out. And they're just like, I can't believe you did that. And sometimes it's, I can see stuff because I made so many that other people can't see. They think their problem is joint number 3 and it's joint number 5. Mm-hmm. And I get on that one and they haven't even been messing with that. They're messing with number 3 and I go down to number 5 and it all straightens out. And they're like, you know, and it's just like, I've just made, you know, thousands of them, you know, I know what I'm looking for. That's a different, skill set as far as just being able to see, you know, I can just look down at it and count them 1, 2, 3. There it is right there. Boom. You know, where other people can't. And it's hard to teach that sometimes.
Right.
You know, you sit there and you tell somebody that, oh, this is what you're doing. And, you know, but, you know, it just doesn't always, they don't always get it.
Something that I want people to get that I was thinking about before you got here. And I was like, man, I really just want you to speak to it. Cause I've mentioned it a few times since we talked and I don't know how much you want to talk about water. That's one of your specialties.
Well, I've worked in a water plant for 24 years now. Mm-hmm. I treat water, drinking water every day, mm-hmm. you know? And I don't mind talking about it. People, oh, this isn't true. This isn't true. And, so many people just filter their water and drink it. And it's just like, you know, you're asking for crazy. You know, boiling's the, you know, you have to put some kind of treatment. You know, all these microorganisms. And there's no filter that takes out any viruses or anything like that. And, you know. Oh, well, the mesh is good enough. It'll keep out Cryptosporidium and it'll keep out, you know, E. coli and all that kind of stuff. But in our lab at the water plant, we have E. coli samples and stuff like that. They do that. We spike samples for lab people so that we can they would catch if something was going in there. We use it as a catch to, you know, we purposely spike a sample and make it turn colors, like it fluoresces, you know, yellow and stuff like that. And so we're doing that so that we know we can catch it. Mm-hmm. So a few years ago, that's probably been 8 or 9 years ago, I was going to walk the Appalachian Trail and I wanted to see what kind of filter, cause all these people, and so I just randomly took it to the lab and put a positive E. coli sample, and dang, it was positive on the other side. Mm-hmm. And it said it stopped it. And I was like, whoa, you know, and probably why more people don't get sick, is it doesn't have the stuff in it. You know, like you're walking the Appalachian Trail, if you're getting your water from the top of the mountain, there's not a lot of stuff that can get into it at that point. You know, it's such a, you know, crazy thing to sit there and go, well, this filter says this. And I hate the terminology kills. This filter kills this stuff. And, you know, I work at a $50 million water plant. We can't kill any of this stuff. They don't kill it. What anything like chlorine does is it makes it where it can't reproduce. That's what all these things do into your, they get into your stomach and they reproduce exponentially. And it's so quickly, it just comes out both ends. That's when you get sick, that's what happens. Mm-hmm. So when you drink something that, you know, is bad, that, and that's game over in a survival situation, because it's coming out both ends. You're already probably dehydrated anyway, and that's going to dehydrate you more. So that's a crazy, you know, don't drink water without even, you know, anything at all. But when you boil water, it makes it where they can't reproduce. It makes them inert. And that's like, you've always heard when you're trying to get pregnant, don't get in a hot tub, you know, because it's so hot, it'll make your sperm inert. That's what it's doing. That's the same thing it's doing with these microorganisms. You know, chlorine's not killing them. It's making them where they can't reproduce. And mm-hmm. and so your water's got it in it. You know, common drinking water's got E. coli in it, but it's they're not, you know, they're inert and they come out.
Can you speak to that point when we were leaving, Brian and I were leaving, you were talking about how when people go away to say like Mexico or they go to a third world country and then they come back after a couple of weeks, and they say, oh, I must have eaten something, I've gotten sick. But you talked about how it was the residual water in the pipes, right?
Well, like, say you live like in the country, and the your house is 200, you know, 300 yards from the road, and the water at your running in front of your house is good, but from your meter to your house, in 2 weeks, say you went to Mexico for 2 weeks, and I'm not picking on Mexico. There's any country, but the water in your pipe, the chlorines ran out of it. So then they're not inert anymore, and you could get sick. So when you go back on a vacation, flush your water lines, you know, because and then you what happens is you come back and you say, oh, I got food poisoning because you know, it was that bad Mexican food I ate or whatever, you know, or the airport had crazy food and that made me sick. And
how long does it take to flush the water lines?
I mean, there's a way to figure that out. You'd have to figure out the diameter and the length and stuff like that. But it wouldn't be, you know, 5 minutes, you know.
Okay.
It wouldn't take long to do something like that. You know, come home and take a shower.
Right.
You know,
right.
Or, you know, flush the toilet a couple times and take a shower. But don't just come out and drink the water just right out of the freaking tap. It could be. And I'm not saying it is and that all of them are, but I think some cases of what people are considering food poisoning is a water illness. You know, they've got it from something like something simple like that. And you can do that from, and that's where people kill me about wells. You know, all the water comes from the ocean. And you're like, what? And what happens is the sun makes the ocean evaporate, and it becomes, you know, and it takes the saline out of it, and it comes up into clouds, it comes rain, and you know, it's hydrological cycles, what they call all that. So even your well water is coming from that same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's not water in the ground. The earth's molten in the center. It's not filled with water. So it's only down so far. You know, that's where all the lava and stuff's coming from volcanoes and stuff like that. So even if you've got a well, you're drinking all this crazy stuff anyway.
You talked one time about the pharmaceuticals that are surprisingly in water supplies. Like, is there a remedy at home that people can use? Like, what would you suggest?
There's nothing you can use. See, like, all the people that put like Roundup on their lawn, and you'll see them in the neighborhoods, and then they take their grass and they blow it out into the street, and then it rains and it goes down into the storm drain, which goes into the creek. Mm-hmm. We can't take stuff like that out of the water. There's no way. We don't know how. It's proprietary. Their ingredients are, you know, we can't do. And the same thing with pharmaceuticals. You know, anything that you're on, like a maintenance drug, like an antidepressant, anti-anxiety, birth control pills, you're sitting there and you're drinking these things because they're built up in your system. You're peeing them out. It's going into the sewer plant. And then, you know, they're taking all the crap out of it. But we can't remove stuff that we don't know that's there. Mm-hmm. You know, we can hit big stuff. We can hit mercury or arsenic or something like that. But all these little things like that, we don't know anything about that.
Damn.
You know, but you know, even well water has got that in it because it's been going on for, you know, people, what, in the 60s is when birth control pills mm-hmm. came out.
Yeah, generations.
Yeah. So that water just keeps getting reused.
What are your thoughts on the Ohio train derailment? Because that was something that we didn't experience. Like, that didn't happen when we went out and visited you.
Yeah.
And now they're saying it's like chemical Chernobyl, and the water is so greatly impacted. They said it will take years to remediate.
Oh yeah. And see, like, you don't know what got into the water. Mm-hmm. And you don't know how far it traveled. And you know, there's people like, well, I'm on a well. Wells are impacted too with that. And at least with a municipal water system, they could get water piped in from another city that, you know, like they're all basically connected. You know, mm-hmm. I work at a Concord plant. We're connected to Charlotte's water. We've connected to Kannapolis' water. Kannapolis is connected to Salisbury's water. You could, in an emergency, we could pipe water to these other places. So, you know, we could do that.
Yeah.
Where well, it's a, you know, if it gets into the groundwater, you know, it's going. And see, I just moved into a house last year, and it had a freaking oil tank buried.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh. And the guy came out to inspect it, and he said, well, if it's leaking, your well's contaminated. And it was like 50 feet from my well. I mean, it wasn't far at all. Well, he drilled into the ground with this big old auger thing, and as soon as he pulled the drill bit out, I could smell the oil. I was like, oh yeah, thing's leaking, of course. You know, put there in the 50s. But I could tell, you could just smell the oil. And I was like, dang. But then it got really scary because he starts walking at all the neighbors looking for wells and saying, oh, you're going to have to pay for your neighbor's wells if they're contaminated too. And God. I was like, oh man. But none of them were on wells. They all had city water. But I was like, whoa. And you just don't, if anything within 200 yards of that was considered contaminated.
Oh my God. Not to mention if someone ever got sick.
Yeah.
And the medical bill, like, oh my God.
And you're talking a little well, I mean, a little oil, it probably was like 50 gallons or something like that, that's buried. And how much of that is in the ground? We had an incident at the water lines, and it was an old car dealership thing, and they started putting a water line in there, and they found like thousands of batteries that this car dealer had buried in the ground. And everybody, the soil was so contaminated, everybody that walked on it, that you had to turn your boots in, and they bought you brand new boots. That was that crazy. And I was like, and I just walked across it. I didn't even like get in a hole or anything like that. And I was like, this is crazy. Mm-hmm. And we have no idea what they were doing back in the day on water. I can show you in Concord, they have all these, Cannon Mills had all these different, where they're making towels and all these different things. Where the dye house was, mm-hmm. the rocks are still dyed. They're still blue and red and green in the creek. They would just flush the dyes right into the creek. You know, what they did back in the past is crazy. But there's only X amount of water on the earth.
Right.
You know, we're drinking the water that Stone Age man was drinking. Mm-hmm. It just gets recycled. And I don't know when the point is that it's not going to be recyclable anymore. You know, when you see like I said, you see the ocean and how other countries don't do all the pollution and stuff like that. You're just like, man.
Yeah, the giant plastic field that's in the Pacific floating around from Asia that, you know, apparently is our problem and we won't address it. You know, like.
You know, that's everybody's problem.
That's everyone's problem, right?
You know, it's this crazy thing.
Man, well, Doug, I'll tell you, like, I think, like I said at the beginning of the podcast, you're one of the authorities that I look to. You do a little bit of everything. I mean, everything from the past, right? We're talking primitive technology through modern water treatment and every point in between. Where can people find you to get more information, read about the blowguns, you know, take courses with you? You know, where can people go to find more?
Okay. My website is stoneagesurvival.com. I went through Squarespace to make the website, and it's a great little thing, but they try to make you get a business PayPal account when you do that. And then they charge me more money. So I just have my email on there to sit there. And if you want to take one of my classes, but all my classes are listed on there. My book and everything, it's all listed on there. So that's the big thing. My book's also available on Amazon. It's Native American Blowguns. So you can get me there. I teach classes at the Shield Museum, kind of as a nod to Steve, and they're on their website. I do several classes a year for them. They do a big nap in August, the first weekend in August. And that's a nap in is a thing where a bunch of flint nappers get together and make stone tools and stuff like that. And that's free. You can just come. Mm-hmm. So that's a free event. And I'm actually talking about Danish daggers there this year. I'm the speaker this year there. I do classes at my house. I like to, I'll do them other places too, but I like to do them at my house because every time you teach something like this, we go down rabbit holes. Somebody mentions something. Oh, well, I got one of those in the other room, and I'll pull it out. And you know, wherever I'm teaching a class, you know, 10 hours from my house, well, I've got one of those at my house, you know, and that's about the extent of it. You can't really, but you know, a lot of my replica stuff's all hands-on stuff. You know, I sit there and hand it to you and you look at it and feel it. And cause it's a different, like when you have a club in your hand, when you look at a picture of a club, mm-hmm. it's big difference when you look at a picture and then hold one in your hand and go, oh, I can see where this will be damaged now. It makes it more realistic. I teach at my house. Man, I teach at the Shield Museum because that's close to my house. I'm doing a class with, I think in October, for the Gray-Bearded Green Beret. Mm-hmm. That's on his website. I go to Rabbit Stick every year. So you can see me at Rabbit Stick if you're on the West Coast. So that's pretty much, and I'm in Kannapolis, which is outside of Charlotte. So I'm like right outside of the big city. And if you were flying in to take a class, I'd come pick you up at the airport. It's not a problem.
Outstanding.
That's what I'm doing. My next class I'm teaching is Primitive Game Calls. It's the 15th of this month. It's a Saturday. It's at my house. We're going to make three different types of turkey calls, a predator call, and then I've got seven or eight other ones and whatever they want to make as far as what time we got in a day. But we're definitely going to do the turkey and a predator call and then go from there.
And it seems like there's always something new every single class, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, always something new.
And I don't repeat a lot of classes. Steve, it was amazing in... You know, the 30 plus years he taught, he only repeated like a dozen classes. Mm-hmm. They were all new classes. It keeps it interesting. Because I'll do something that scratch the surface on, but I'm not an expert on it. But I'll force myself to learn it. And that helps me as a teacher, because I'm always learning then. But I'll sit here and, you know, like I've got 50 classes. I try to do one a month. But I've got 50 classes that I already want to do in over the next 6 or 7 years, and they're all different. So that's where, you know, that I'm trying to do something different. Because I hate teaching survival.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's hard to teach. I can sit here and tell you how to survive this and how to survive that. But at the end of the day, there's hundreds of cases where people did everything textbook wrong and they made it. They lived. Right. And then there's another 100 people or more cases where they did everything textbook right and they still died. And a lot of that's mental. And that's a hard thing to teach.
And you can't sell it.
Right. So that's a iffy thing. And I still think in my lifetime, you know, there's all these schools that I'll take a year-long class with me and I'll certify you as an instructor to teach survival. Okay. Someday, a certified instructor is going to die. And then do you not, how can his family not sue the people that certified him as an instructor? Or he's going to teach somebody else something and it's going to get in there. Well, he's a certified instructor with so-and-so. In my lifetime, someone's going to get in a survival situation and die. And it's, and even if they don't see you, if they go, well, he was certified with this school, is your school just not going to go?
Right.
You know,
right.
The bad publicity would be terrible. So I'm not a big fan of, I teach skills that will help you survive. I could do it. I could sit here and do a week-long survival course. There's certain things you can teach and there's certain things you can't teach, but the actual survival thing is a tough one to sell to for me, because, you know, I can't make you survive. I can help you make an addle out of, and, you know, you can use that to survive, but I can't, you know, when it comes down to that last, you know, you're in that really dire situation, I can't teach that.
Right.
You know, and people fool you if they tell you that they can't teach that. You know, because David Alloway, you know that guy? He wrote Desert Survival Skills.
Mm-hmm.
Super talent. His book is incredible. He died. He was out in the desert, broke his leg.
Yeah.
And he made it back, but the infection was so bad, it killed him.
When it's your time, it's your time.
Right.
You know?
And so, you know, that was probably one of the most, at the time, the most competent desert survival instructor out there. I mean, his book was Desert Survival Skills. And, you know, that's just one of those, whoa, you know, where he did, and he did everything right. And he made it back, but he still died. So.
Well, if nothing else, then take the courses to make your life better.
Right.
And hope that you never get into those scenarios.
Absolutely.
And if you do, then you'll have a better chance. But we're coming to the end of this one. Guys, please check out Doug's stuff. I'm going to tell you that, you know, of all the instructors I've met, Doug's one of the most competent. And you will definitely get something from him. And I promise you, you're gonna enjoy the process of learning whatever he has to show. So, Doug, thanks so much for coming on. And I'm looking forward to the next time, you know, we can get together. But for now, guys, thank you so much for listening to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. Until next time.